Welcome to the government. I'm Alex, and with me is James. He's very silent. Before we get started, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search The MacGuffinmen, all one word. You can try any other variety of podcast apps and see if we show up on those. And follow us on Twitter, at The MacGuffinmen. We most recently talked about Star Wars The Force Awakens, and I think that's about it. So yeah, we'll get right to the Ennio Morricone theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Another classic Ennio jam.
He's great.
Oh, so great. It's amazing. Like, he hadn't scored a podcast in 40 years until we talked him into doing this.
I know. And at that time, he refused to work with us again.
But... yeah, because of our misuse of his previous themes in our previous podcasts.
Do you think anyone's figured it out yet?
I mean, do you think anybody's listening? I think is the real question.
Yeah, we're talking about The Hateful Eight today.
The eighth film by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, okay. You want to start there?
Yeah, I mean, like, is he? I didn't count it up. I assume he's not counting his portion of Four Rooms or his half of From Dusk Till Dawn.
And that is correct.
Okay, like there's, but I assume Death Proof makes the cut.
I haven't seen a complete list from QT himself.
From QT himself, handwritten, of course, or it's, typewritten.
I've seen the argument that Kill Bill counts as one movie.
Well, he made it as one.
Right.
Yeah.
But they are, you know. Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
This is what I'm saying. It depends on how you cut it. If that's one movie or if you count, Death Proof or, yeah.
Well, let's just count them up real quick. Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Kill Bill 1, Kill Bill 2, Death Proof, Inglourious Bastards, Django, Hateful Eight. So this would be 9. So he must count Kill Bill as one movie.
Or not Death Proof.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Yeah.
Stimulating anyway. Radio thus far.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, but we saw this film together and
holding hands
a little laugh
the entire time.
Yeah. One earbud in each ear.
As we do.
Yep. And we both had a little laugh when the eighth film by Quentin Tarantino came up as part of the film itself.
Yeah, exactly. Especially since it cuts to black, like you're seeing some landscape shots over like the Weinstein Company Presents and stuff like that, and then cuts to black for that card and the title card, you know? Yeah. Great. Played well in the room too. I really enjoyed it. I like it when people laugh at that stuff with me.
Yeah. And I mean, this was all part of the roadshow that we saw,
mm-hmm.
The roadshow version of this movie, which had the overture and the intermission as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we'll talk about Quentin Tarantino as Quentin Tarantino throughout this, and maybe this will be part of your answer, but how do you feel about having a roadshow version of a movie at all? And, you know, we'll get to some of the other things that make this movie unique, but let's start with that.
Well, okay, so I feel kind of conflicted about it in this case because I feel like it has kind of been talked about so much that it is talked about. Like, we're literally talking about the roadshow before we're talking about the actual movie, and I think the movie is definitely worth talking about. And I found that in a lot of the promotional materials, it's the roadshow has been talked about so much, and I think it's kind of like downplaying the movie itself. But in general, the fact that a roadshow exists is cool. The way that this has been done is cool. My greatest fear about my own life is that the movie theater is going to die before I do. So anything that brings importance into people actually going to a movie theater will always make me happy. You know? Just because I want to be able to continue going to the movie theaters and focusing on a movie and nothing else. You know?
Yeah. Okay. So as part of that, the intermission, you know, it's not the way that you enjoy your movies for the most part. I know typically when you watch a movie, you watch it
front to back with no breaks and no distractions, ideally, of course.
Yeah. And then frequently I start another one immediately after.
So how did you feel about kind of being forced to take a break in a film, especially seeing it for the first time in the movie theater?
It was nice. It wasn't the first time. The first time I saw 2001, I saw it as a roadshow at TIFF with an intermission. And the intermission in 2001 is equally good. It's like, to quote Quentin Tarantino talking about it, he says the intermission in 2001, it's like, it's such a plotless movie. And then right when some semblance of a plot gets injected to the movie is when you have to go to intermission. It's right when when Hal starts fighting back, basically. And the same could be said about, not the same, but a similar, a sort of escalation happens right at the intermission. And you can kind of feel the intermission about to happen. And that's why I think that that intermission title card gets a, gets a laugh when you see it, because it's like everybody knows that this was just such a big moment that has just happened, and now we gotta fucking fill 10 minutes, you know?
So yeah, and I think part of the laugh that comes at the intermission is a bit of nervous laughter. I mean, we have that long speech by Samuel Jackson, and you know, that's just nervous laughter is a common thing after a tense moment. And you know, we have this long story, we have I like the story he tells, and then also within the narrative, that is just a very tense situation of violent people with guns in a confined space, not being very trusting of each other. And people who write films, or people who write television where you don't have to account for commercials, they talk about, you know, having to write around, not having to worry about writing around commercials or, you know, intermission, things like that. So it is interesting that he kind of chose to insert this intermission and, you know, kind of have this break that some people really are happy that they don't have to do it when they don't have to do it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And is it just to kind of, I guess I'm trying to get what you think his motivation for that is. Is it to have an intermission to make it seem like an older movie, because he obviously is a fan of older movies? Or is it a kind of a way to really punctuate that story and to give it a bit more of an impact and kind of let people kind of focus on that for a little bit, you know, for 12 more minutes than they would if the movie just flowed through the way it was? Or is it a combination of it or something else?
It's a combination. And also, like, part of the movie's design was always the roadshow. Like when Tarantino and Robert Richardson, his DOP, started talking about shooting it in 70mm Panavision, they kind of had to figure out a way to sell Harvey Weinstein on it. Well, specifically Harvey, but Harvey and Bob. And so from that point, they started to have to think about a way to sell this movie. And the way to sell it was, well, we're using this old technology, it's going to be a long, long movie, let's sell it in this old sort of way. And I think that was a big part of it. It was that it sort of fit the vibe of what they wanted to do visually, and also the sort of throwback aspect, the throwback to movies being, you know, a thing for your evening. You know, it's something that you have to mark out time for. This thing was initially only going to run for 2 weeks. It seems like its success has expanded its run. It's certainly running for a third week here in Toronto. But it was supposed to be this limited sort of engagement. And so they really wanted to make it like a limited thing. And what was the last movie you saw with an intermission, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. Even Quentin Tarantino's previous movie, which I think is like 2 minutes longer than the intermissionless Hateful Eight, doesn't have an intermission. Yeah. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And you've kind of expressed a bit of negative feelings to the way that whole idea of selling it has taken away from the product itself. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's a confusing thing to tackle, because this whole movie is predicated on you slowly learning things. So it's kind of a hard movie to sell in any capacity. And pretty much the only thing you can tell people about this movie without kind of ruining something is that it's, you know, eight or nine people alone in this cabin during a blizzard, you know, and
you wouldn't want to say 8 or 9.
Well, yeah. Well, there's spoiled something. You know, there's the Hateful Eight, and then plus OB. So there are 9 people, I believe. Before people start dying, and before people show up under the floorboards, and before flashbacks happen, but yeah. So it's like, I recognize that it's a hard movie to sell, and I think that's just kind of the way they leaned on it. And
I thought putting Quentin Tarantino's name on a movie sells it.
Yeah, well, it does that too. And I mean, he's the biggest celebrity in this movie, you know. At least at this point, you know.
Channing Tatum.
Well, the biggest celebrity that you could put in an interview. Like, you couldn't put Channing Tatum on Jimmy Kimmel's couch talking about this movie and then not have it draw undue attention to when is Channing Tatum going to show up in this movie, right?
Oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
It's like, I was actually, I'm kind of surprised that they even put his name in the credits. Like, I, after seeing the movie, it seems sort of like it could have been like a Kevin Spacey 7 sort of situation where he just removes himself from all promotional materials and the opening credits to retain the surprise. And obviously Channing Tatum in 2015, 2016 is a bigger star than Kevin Spacey was around 7, but not by that much. So I don't know. It was kind of tricky, you know? And so I don't fault them for that. I think it's part of out of necessity. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, I wish they could talk about the movie, but also talking about the movie would ruin a lot of the things that I love about the movie, you know?
Right.
So it's the 8th film from Quentin Tarantino, and that's the best way to market it. Just let's all be excited that one of the most interesting American auteurs is back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's a damn good movie. How do you feel about it?
Yeah. I liked it. I liked it a lot. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, not to say it's boring or unsurprising, but it's what we've come to expect from Quentin Tarantino, which is the opposite of boring and surprising, really. I just don't make it seem like it's just more of the same thing. You know, you can definitely see his fingerprints all over it and hear his voice in it, literally. Mm-hmm. But it's good. I love Westerns. I think Westerns are such a great fit for Quentin Tarantino. And that's why I'm not surprised at all when I hear, that's why I wasn't surprised when I heard after Django, he kind of wanted to spend some more time in that time period. Mm-hmm. It's a very violent time period. It's a great time for lying and bluffing. You know, it's just a time of incomplete information and people not being able to access the truth. And I think that is something that he likes to play with a lot, kind of pretending to be someone you're not, even in his movies that aren't set in the Old West at all. But obviously in Django and in this one, it's leaned on very, very heavily.
Yeah. And he loves sort of focusing on the, these just moments where nothing is happening as well. And there was just less happening in the 1800s, you know, like even if you watch Pulp Fiction, like, if you watch Pulp Fiction thinking like Pulp Fiction could have been like Seinfeld if Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld were hitmen in the 80s as opposed to comedians, you know, like there's just so much focus on the mundane aspects of life, even when people are being murdered, you know, and like one of the things that I remember so much about Pulp Fiction is that we actually see them cleaning up a body and it just being such a normal part of their life, you know, and they just have to talk to fill the time and stuff like that. And there is so much talking to fill the time in the Old West just because there's so much more time to fill, you know? And so it really fits his style. And Tarantino has always liked those in-between moments, you know?
Yeah. Oh, Pulp Fiction could be 5 different movies, you know, and for a movie where so much stuff happens, you are watching people sit and talk for a lot of it. But
yeah, for sure.
But to get back to Hateful Eight, yeah, that is a lot of this. I mean, there is a lot of violence in it, but it's all pretty backloaded. I mean, some people get punched and hit, you know, throughout the movie. But
one person gets punched and hit throughout the movie.
Yeah, for most of it, it is her. That's true. But yeah, I think it, you know, you think back on this movie and you see heads explode, you see people covered with blood, you see people vomiting blood, but there is so much of this that is talking or, yeah. you know, threatening or bluffing or trying to surmise the truth out of someone and trying to see people's real feelings and identities and things like that. But, I mean, that's what he does is mix the mundane with the incredible. And, you know, that's something we see throughout his career.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this movie is kind of, exactly what I was kind of hoping for from him at this point is that, you know, when we talked about Inglourious Basterds on this podcast, probably 2-3 years ago, I mentioned my favorite sequences are the opening and the basement bar, which is two prolonged sequences of conversation followed by quick bursts of action. And in Django,
and I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And in Django, the best thing is certainly the dinner sequence where Leo's talking about phrenology and all that stuff. And this movie is those types of sequences, but it's just that in totality. And I loved it. I loved it so much. I love that he has now, like, I mean, somebody that's always been confident, obviously, yeah. now has the confidence. Sorry, what were you saying?
To a fault, maybe sometimes. Personally, not in his work.
Yeah, personally, like he's properly confident as far as his own skills are, as far as filmmaking goes. And I like some properly placed confidence from time to time. But that he, you know, like I like seeing directors get less showy with time, you know, and I think Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master is a good linchpin for that in his career. Like he slows down a bit with There Will Be Blood, but The Master is this really slow down sort of movie. And I think that's where you see them sort of realizing that, and Quentin Tarantino's a good pairing for him just because they were such flashy 90s enfant terrible, you know, together, and they made such flashy movies that, and they've both slowed down over time and are still making really good movies that look totally different from their previous movies. And I think that's where you sort of see just this, the element of control. Like they really sort of gain control over how to tell a story. And the fact that, you know, that shot of the jelly bean in The Hateful Eight, when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, jelly bean. What is the jelly bean? You know, and like, and I just immediately started thinking about, well, this is going to matter at some point, because anything that matters early on in this movie was going to matter by the end of it. You know, like you knew somebody was going to read the Lincoln letter out loud at some point, even though Kurt Russell doesn't when it first shows up, you know, and it just really sort of sets your mind racing in this movie that every time you get a new piece of information, you get to start thinking about when that piece of information is going to come into play. And
Chekhov's jelly bean, as they say,
Chekhov's jelly bean, Chekhov's Lincoln letter.
Yeah.
And
what you're saying about you know, kind of having more confidence to do something smaller, I mean, this the story is just one for that exact skill set that you're describing. You know, it's not a huge showy movie visually. It's not, you know, big battle scenes or anything like you might expect. It's, you know, for the most part, kind of a locked room sort of movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you said, to kind of grow up, to age and kind of get some confidence and move away from, not necessarily stylish, because I think in ways this is still a stylish movie and Quentin Tarantino's good at making stylish things, but just not very flashy, you know, not a spectacle by any means, but still something very pleasant to look at.
Yeah, for sure. And most of the visual stylistic choices aren't ones that draw attention to themselves immediately. Like after we saw this movie, I mentioned to you that there were no zooms in it. And I thought that was surprising because it's a Tarantino staple. Like right in the beginning of Django, there's a snap zoom during the opening credits, you know, and it's when that happened, it was like, yeah, of course there is. We're in Tarantino country, you know. And I found out later that the reason there were no zooms in this movie was because they didn't physically have a zoom lens, because they were using technology that was so old that it didn't have the capacity to zoom. And
zoom in on that jelly bean.
They ended up using a crane for everything that they would have used a zoom for. They just pushed it on a crane instead, and I love that. Yeah, it is still very a stylistic movie, but not in a way that really draws attention to itself, you know, in the way that some stylistic choices that Tarantino has done over the years have.
Oh, okay. Did you think it was odd to have such a big focus on 70mm for, you know, a locked room movie, for something that there are a few shots that are exceptions, but we don't get those grand vistas and, you know, epic sweeping shots that will come with Cinerama and with most Westerns in general.
Yeah. Well, one thing I quickly want to point out, this isn't a Cinerama movie, despite the fact that that logo is at the beginning, which is something okay. that I really enjoy. Cinerama was, you had to project it on three, like it was so wide that you had to use three projectors projecting over like a third of a screen. And there are just so few instances of that actually being done. There's some guy in Ohio that I forget the name of the movie, that actually put together a proper Cinerama version of, I don't know, maybe it's a Mad Mad World or something, but Tarantino actually heard about this and went to visit him and watch the print in Ohio, but it took him like over 10 years to put together and function and all that. But it's just kind of another little thing throughout this movie where nothing is as it seems. You know, is this actually the eighth film from Quentin Tarantino? Is this actually Cinerama? Is anything fucking true? Did Fred Raskin actually edit this movie? You know? But 70mm, I don't think it's odd because one of the things that he was really doing was using the wide frame, the 2.76:1, which, you know, in traditional filmmaking, the widest you're going to see is 2.40:1. And say that that's generally used on big action movies, you know, like Michael Mann loves that widescreen aspect ratio. And this is even wider than that. So it sort of gave you not a view of the whole haberdashery at any given moment, but the majority of it anytime you're in a wide shot. And so it really played into the whole staging aspect of this movie where you could have Daisy and John Ruth talking in the right side of the screen and then Bob, OB lying on the floor next to the fire in the, and getting up and walking out of frame in the background. And that was the thing that he really wanted to use it for. And I mentioned The Master earlier. That was shot, and I saw it on 70mm as well. And the things that really jumped out at me in The Master were the close-ups. Like, there's that close-up of Joaquin close-up heavy scene of Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman when PSH is doing the reading of Joaquin, and it's just these close-ups, and they're just so pristine and beautiful. And that's kind of how I felt about the 70 mil in this movie too, in The Hateful Eight. The close-ups of people's faces whenever they were on a long lens, it was just so gorgeous. Like, that first close-up in the movie is when right after John Ruth pistol whips Daisy, and we see her like look up and talk, and blood starts running down her face. And that's the first close-up of a face in the movie. And it's just, it's stunning. It's so unbelievable, the amount of detail and like the humanity that you can see in her face, just because you can see every aspect of her face, like every detail. And you can like count the pores. And that continues on throughout the movie pretty much anytime we get a close-up. It's just so staggeringly beautiful, you know?
Yep.
That so like, I don't mind that they didn't use the vistas. You know, I've seen some people complaining that, you know, this is a technology used a filmmaking tool used for bigness, you know. And I mean, just because it is used for bigness doesn't mean it has to be. Christopher Nolan used it really great for Interstellar. Quentin Tarantino used it really great for Faces, you know, like.
Yeah. And I mean, and thematically, I mean, it's just about, especially after Intermission or whatever, chapter 5 for people who didn't see the Roadshow version, and it's revealed that Daisy has a secret, you know, she's seen something now. You know, it's about seeing everything. It's about trying to get as much information from these people to figure things out. And there are instances throughout of Gage or Ruth or someone seeing something or hearing something or piecing something together, and that moving the plot forward, or at least affecting the way people are acting within this narrative. And it's not, you know, this grand spectacle. It's not this epic scene that is what gets this across. It's about just having this wide ranging view of all these kind of small things and just taking in as much as you can, even these little details that don't seem important.
and, you know, not taking everything you witness as truth, and, you know, just kind of that wide swath of hearing as much, seeing as much, getting as much in, and that is what forms your opinion. And, you know, we see people figure things out. We see Gage understand that this letter isn't this Lincoln letter isn't really from Lincoln, that it's made up, and just that comes with, you know, paying attention and just having all this information coming in. And that's something that lines up with this, you know, the widescreen aspect of the way it was put together.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, if you kind of just whatever you're looking at right now, you know, like just focus on the way that your eyes work. Like, your eyes are just a really, really advanced super wide angle lens, and you kind of see that. You can see a lot on the sides, even though they're not things that you're actually looking at. And it's just, I find generally the wider your frame is, the closer to human vision it is, you know? And I think this movie especially kind of works in that way. Like, you can look at the room the same way you would be looking at the room if you were actually in it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when it really does almost fill in all of your periphery, it's just, it's immersive. And I think a movie like this that kind of wants you to feel immersed and not, I mean, you're in this cabin, it's not cramped. I mean, it's a pretty big cabin, but there's this many people, but it's just this idea that the blizzard's outside, no one's braving it. No one even entertains the idea of leaving this place, mm-hmm. you know, even when they feel that they're in a bad situation, there's just never any, like, that's just not an option. So it, you know, just adds into that feeling of this is the world you're in, this movie that you're watching, you're a part of it, and everybody in this movie is, and this is your world as it is right now, for better or worse. And in a Quentin Tarantino movie, almost always worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Did you have any opinion on the importance of the statue of Jesus that we start on, or the crucifix, I guess?
I think the thing that, I would think about is that I think it's just sort of setting the tone that, you know, we're about to meet all of these terrible people, who treat each other terribly and, all get murdered in horrible ways by the end of it. And I think it's just like something along the lines of, you know, fictional or not, the best person we've ever produced, you know, depending on your belief system, I would imagine most Quentin Tarantino fans are not God-loving folk. even the best example of us has been tortured, you know, and yeah. Just sort of this sort of truth about humanity that we're all terrible all the time, even to the best people.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a sufficiently grim reading of that for who we're dealing with here.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, that speaks to a very, twisted sense of justice, because the, again, within that story, the people who treated Jesus this way felt that they were in the right, and it wasn't done for greed, you know, not done to make money or to, you know, gain fame for the people who did it. Seemingly, it was just that they felt that this was the right thing to do. And Tarantino has focused on this idea of justice and, you know, vengeance in lots of movies, I guess most clearly in Kill Bill, but Django Unchained, that's obviously the driving factor, it seems. I mean, I guess Broomhilda as well, but vengeance is just such a strong through line throughout that movie. And I think throughout his career, in varying degrees for certain films, more so on the ones that I've mentioned, but we have outright discussions here between civilized justice and frontier justice. And we have lawmen versus, you know, or bounty hunters and lawmen, depending if he was really a sheriff. And, you know, just a lot of discussion about justice and what is true justice. And Walton Goggins, our boy, you know, someone who is fighting on a, you know, fighting for a side of in a war that has ceased, you know, he's got his morality to it, but he seems to still be fighting for this Confederate army that is, you know, should be defunct. And Yeah, I think that's not one that I had thought of, this idea of Jesus as we're all pretty terrible. Even the best of us are going to get treated this way. It's just, I don't know that there's been such a prolonged discussion of justice in Quentin Tarantino's work, even though it's always present.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this is the, I think you could make an argument that he kind of starts a little bit with Inglourious Basterds and it just doesn't quite work. I think the one interesting sort of like message thing that exists in Inglourious Basterds is that film can save the world. And I find that kind of endearing and romantic, just in that what draws Hitler to his death is film, which makes everybody things okay for a lot more people, you know? And with Django, you sort of get, Tarantino sort of starting to try and figure out some things that he would then focus on more in Hateful Eight. But I just sort of think Django was just, I didn't get a lot of message out of the movie. I really enjoyed the movie for sure. Incredibly entertaining, but Hateful Eight, like just sitting there watching it, it was the first Tarantino movie where I sort of felt like heard lines where I was just like, oh, that seems like very on the nose for Tarantino, and in a good way. Like when the Walton Goggins line, when black people are scared, then white people are safe or whatever, which happens in the Stagecoach early on. Obviously, that's not word for word, because I believe the line features a word I don't like saying. But, you know, that those types of lines and the frontier justice being thirst quenching, you know, like the people that killed Jesus, it was like their Gatorade or something, like that sequence is really nice. And those types of things, that there are a few of them throughout the film that I think really feel more modern than Quentin Tarantino movies ever really do, even though he's a very modern filmmaker. You know, it's weird. He's always been hard to describe, but this is the first time where I feel like his actual emotional sentiment or societal sentiment has actually gotten through, you know, in a way that's actually kind of interesting and poignant. You know?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's coincidental, but this would be the point in his career that at least I could recall of him being kind of politicized as a public figure just because of some things he had said.
I don't know.
If that's bleeding through.
Yeah, exactly. I think when he started to talk about police this year, I think it's probably the only time he's spoken into a microphone about something that's not a movie, you know, like, or pop culture related. You know, he is the geek filmmaker, and still is, but this is the first time he ever tried to break away from that in any capacity.
Yeah.
And I don't even think he's actually trying to break away from it, but to add a second shade, you know, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it's interesting.
There are a few filmmakers I've spent more time thinking about, and I still do not have a handle on him. And I think that's what keeps him interesting, is that I never really know what to expect from a Quentin Tarantino movie, even though I know that there are going to be some things that I recognize. Like the fact that I didn't see the floorboard thing coming in this movie is probably like, I should be considering that an insult to my own intelligence that I didn't think of that. Just because he's done it again, and I loved it the first time he did it. And it like in hindsight, it seems so obvious that, cause we see looking down from above, but we never see looking up from downward. But it's just that type of thing where, like, you recognize everything in a Quentin Tarantino movie, but he still does it in this way that just feels new every time. And it's so odd, you know? And, like, and it's, like, because, I mean, other filmmakers that I've mentioned this podcast, Nolan, PTA, those are people that I have, like, hard opinions about how they make films, what they want, what they think the meaning of the film is in their head. And I don't have any of that for pretty much any Quentin Tarantino movie, you know? And I think they're equals, like, as filmmakers. And I would put Fincher in the category with people that I know what he's thinking all the time sort of thing. And I think they're all equals, but I never know what Quentin Tarantino's trying to do, like what he's thinking. And I think that keeps him interesting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, for an auteur who has these things come up over and over, and you know you're watching a Quentin Tarantino movie, and he has all these kind of trademarks. To be that much of a it's kind of denigrating, but to be that much of a brand, but still be interesting and surprising, I think, is an accomplishment.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
And speaking about the character and the floor, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when you do something like that the second time, I feel like that's a really surprising one, because unless you do it every time, to do it more than once still is kind of a shock. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and like in The Hateful Eight, when the shot turns to behind Joe Gage and we start going down, I was like, oh, what weapon does he have? And then the shot keeps going down. And as we got under the floorboards, I got so excited. I was like, oh, this is the best, you know, like, because we've been in this room for probably an hour and a half at that point. And, you know, the movie exists a little bit before they get to the haberdashery. But just, I don't know, that something totally new like that could be revealed. I loved it. I loved it so much.
Yeah. And kind of also speaks to what we were talking about getting as much information as you can. But also there are things you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you can pay attention. You can try to be a detective. But then there's this unknown. There's a whole other person.
Yeah, exactly.
A great person.
And a what? Sorry.
And a great person.
Yeah. Yeah. Magic Mike himself. Yeah. And another thing that I think, like, filmmaking wise, that I found really kind of surprising and interesting when it happened was when we get our first flashback in the movie, which is right before the intermission. So I think we're probably at like the hour 40 mark when Samuel Jackson is doing his little monologue right before he sets up a defensible murder of Bruce Dern.
Yeah. And
when we get that first flashback to Dern's son, it's like, whoa, it's like really kind of staggering, because you didn't realize that that was a thing that was going to happen in this movie, because you've been so lulled into the way that the movie has moved. It's just moved forward. And now we're jumping backwards. And again, another Tarantino staple that I 100% should have seen coming and just didn't. And it was really exciting when it happened. And then it adds this other element from a filmmaking point of view where, like anything can happen, you know, like, cause we can go to any time, you know, like Tarantino doesn't have this no flashback rule in this movie. You know, he's willing to flashback, and then we get a pretty extensive flashback after the intermission for a bit, and one that provides a lot of interesting information, specifically the red jelly bean that I love so much. And yeah, it was just, it's great. I like being surprised at the movies in a pleasant way, and that's what this movie is. It's like 3 hours and 7 minutes of pleasant surprises.
And that kind of surprise, the best kind of surprise, when you feel like you shouldn't be surprised.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of makes you feel like an idiot, but like a really satisfied idiot. So you're okay with it.
Yeah. Okay. How do you like his cameo in this one?
Tarantino?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Great. Big fan. I also, in general, like, I like Tarantino as an actor, and I think, he gets kind of a bad rap. I think he's so good in Pulp Fiction, despite the fact that that scene is built around him saying a totally unnecessary word 100 times more than he should.
Yeah.
But I think he's really good in that scene. I think he's good in Reservoir Dogs. I think he would have acted in a lot more things if he didn't get so goddamn famous after Pulp Fiction. I just in general think he's a very charismatic person who performs in a way that not a lot of, like, nobody's able to pull off. He's a critic. Like, he talks like a critic all the time, even when he's acting. And he's the only critic that has the natural charisma to be able to do that in front of a camera, you know? And it's just this weird sort of thing that only he can do. And I would like him to act more, but he, you know, he's just so famous that he draws too much attention away from the thing that he would be acting in. Which is why he doesn't, like, physically pop up in many of his movies anymore post Pulp Fiction. You know, he's in Django physically, but other than that, I think it's all voice cameos.
Yeah.
Oh, and he's in Death Proof.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that argument hold a lot of water when he's acting with other very famous people? I mean, doesn't acting with Brad Pitt, the kind of the name that's been kind of the go-to male celebrity for probably a long time now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Add up.
They're just
not more famous than him.
No, he's not, but they're just such different kinds of famous, you know, like And it, yes, I recognize it's a weird thing to explain, but Brad Pitt is famous in a different way than Quentin Tarantino is famous. Quentin Tarantino is famous in a different way than Kurt Russell is famous. Because we see them as like this, we see Tarantino as, well, and also Tarantino doesn't act in his roles. He's reading his lines like Tarantino reads his lines, and I just find him an engaging presence. So I think that's part of it. You're comparing Brad Pitt, who I think is a very talented actor, to and somebody that can, despite his star presence, really sort of slink into a role in a way that I don't think Quentin Tarantino ever could. So that's part of it. I in general find Quentin Tarantino an engaging stage presence that cannot act, I think is what I'm saying. I just am engaged by him and enjoy watching him speak, fictionally or non-fictionally. And, you know, if he wasn't famous, I think he'd be able to play the same character in a lot of different movies successfully.
Yeah, I could see him being, I don't know the term for a character actor who plays one character over and over.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's like
he has no range, but he has kind of that fourth, you know, that your main character's best friend that is very funny, but you never want to see him get the girl.
Yeah, exactly. He's Jay Baruchel in the Apatow universe, you know. Yeah, like he always makes me laugh, but you can never remember what his character's name is.
Yeah. How about the kind of Tarantino trademarks here? They leaned pretty heavily on the red apple cigarettes this time.
Yeah, I mean, they just mentioned it a couple of times, but I enjoyed it. I don't know. It's just, I mean, if it wasn't in the movie, I wouldn't like the movie any less. Like, and I don't think it makes me like it anymore, but I don't know. There's something charming about it.
Yeah, I like it too. I think it's great when they do it. I mean, they leaned on they focused on the red apple cigarettes are my favorite. I mean, that's only two lines of dialogue, but I think when you're looking for certain things and then you're like, oh, I found it. And they're like, yeah, look, you found it.
Yeah. Well,
then it gets a bit much.
And the first time it's talked about, Bob says it in a different language. So, I mean, it's kind of like cued in. But then when they actually say red apple later on, you know.
Yeah. I like the Spanish one.
Yeah. No, it's great.
Yeah. And I missed the trunk shots.
You want him to get back to an era with cars? You want him to do a movie about the Model T?
Well, no. But, I mean, we talked
about... Do they have trunks? I don't know. That might not actually work.
That's what the T stands for. Okay. We talked about this in Django, though. I mean, you don't need the trunk. It was... I thought the moment in Django was when Broomhilda was being let out of the hot box. And I was just so expecting that shot to shot from inside. And we didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is in this one. I don't know if it's... Jody coming out of the basement in that kind of shot, or even someone's luggage being unpacked from a stagecoach in that shot. But I know it's not a big deal, but it just seems like if we're going to have that much red apple stuff, you can give me my trunk shot.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, in Inglourious Basterds, when they do that shot, there's no trunk anywhere nearby. It's from the point of view of a character lying on the ground, of which there are many options for that in The Hateful Eight. So it's I mean, it was just a choice that I assume they didn't feel like it fit, so they didn't do it. Yeah. And I enjoy that. I enjoy filmmakers with trademarks that also don't feel like they need to hit them, you know? And and obviously I think Tarantino's smart enough to know when he's shoehorning something in and when something actually works organically, you know? People are smoking in this movie, so red apple cigarettes fit. People are not eating cereal with milk in this movie, so Frankenberry or whatever that cereal is he's used a couple times in the past does not fit.
Yeah, I feel like the shot is so easy, but anyway, we'll move on.
Okay, so sorry. Maybe there's a deleted scene somewhere. Yeah. Although I feel like there are probably never deleted scenes in Quentin Tarantino movies.
No, because he doesn't select.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a shot in the American Cinematographer article about this movie where Bob Richardson is shooting on one camera and Quentin Tarantino is shooting on another camera. And I was just like, hold on. You don't select, you direct, sir. But it actually says in the caption, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Richardson in a rare two-camera shot. I really enjoyed that.
That's funny.
Yeah. Because for those that don't know, Quentin Tarantino just shoots with one camera. And he once said, I don't even remember what the context was, but I don't select, I direct. Or I don't, some sort of word, like a phrase like that.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah. which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Anytime I see like a three camera setup and some behind the scenes photos, I get kind of bummed out. But
do you think he's one of the best at building tension? I mean, this is a tense movie. It's kind of Reservoir Dogs in the Old West with a couple exceptions. Or is it?
I mean, well, Reservoir Dogs, I mean, it doesn't physically cover more ground because I don't know how far they travel in the stagecoach, the first part of the movie. But I mean, there's so much more jumping around in Reservoir Dogs that it feels like a more active movie than it is because there's just so much told in flashback. You know, you just get flashback to Mr. Blonde in Tierney's office. I don't remember what Joe Cabot, I think is his character's name. Them talking about. Or sorry, it was Mr. White and Joe talking about, I don't know, Alabama or something. Sorry?
Breaking Bad? Mr. White? What?
Yeah, exactly. and so there was just more jumping around in Reservoir Dogs. And I think that really speaks to sort of the modern and past Tarantino in that in the past, he sort of felt like he had to jump around because he wasn't as confident enough in his storytelling abilities. And now he realizes he doesn't need to jump around as much. He does do some jumping around, but even then it's only temporarily, you know, like there's not much physical jumping. Like in the Samuel Jackson flashback, we're in a place we don't quite know where they are, but it looks like where the stagecoach has been, you know? Yeah. And when we get the Channing Tatum flashbacks are all within the same location that we spend the majority of the movie in. So yeah, it's Reservoir Dogs ish, but, much more confident Reservoir Dogs, and in a way that, like, since there's so much less jumping around, it feels less like Reservoir Dogs, you know?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. The question that I was getting to, though, was just about the kind of the building of tension in this movie.
Yes. To answer your question, unquestionably, I don't remember the phrasing. Is he one of the best at building tension? Unquestionably.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what do you contribute that to? I mean, I think it's undeniable that he's good at it. I mean, maybe people have some arguments about who would be number one, and you know, I would entertain those. I can't be certain he is number one, but I think it's something he's very good at, and I think those scenes you described of the strongest parts of Inglourious Basterds by your count, and I would say mine as well, are just those very tense moments, the bar in the basement and that initial scene at the farm with the people in the basement and the the milk. I think those are the most successful parts of that movie, and I think it's because the tension is so good, and I think that is something that it's not as identifiable as, you know, violence or Red Apple Cigarettes or something like that, but I think it is one of the signatures, or at least one of the things that elevates his movies in a way that maybe people don't appreciate.
Yes, I would think so. And I think the way that he is able to accomplish these sorts of things is, one, he has patience, right?
Yes.
He obviously, like, I laugh when I watch The Hateful Eight and Samuel Jackson sitting at that table and telling when Mannix has got the gun on Oswaldo, Gage, and Bob. And Sam Jackson says, let's slow it down. Let's slow it way down. Like, the movie's been moving at a breakneck pace at that point, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, he has the patience to take his time with these things. But it's not just the patience that matters. Like, he's willing to take his time. But the fact that he's such a goddamn good dialogue writer allows him to do this in a way that people don't get bored, because the words are just so interesting, and what people are saying to each other is always so entertaining and frequently very funny. And he just sort of has this way with words that just nobody else has. And
it's not very flowery or ornamental or anything. It's usually so conversational. And even in the Old West, in movies and especially in Deadwood and things like that, there's kind of this temptation to make it very poetic and very, you know, just really ornamental. And
talk about the Pueblos.
yeah, it's just not here.
Yeah. I would agree. And And, you know, and like he'll throw in some things that are just weird and weird choices of word, like dingus or bushwhacker. And he also encourages his performers to be sort of to really take the words and be very theatrical and not necessarily in a naturalistic way. So all of these things combine, and he's so good at casting and finding the right people for his very specific type of speaking that he's able to take his time, just because if Tarantino put out a 3-hour movie of somebody walking around a room and monologuing, I feel like I would still like it. You know, like I think it would hold my attention. And so it's these combinations of things, and the fact that he is actually very technically adept and knows how to really build a scene, that he really is able to build suspense in this way, just because he's able to really let a scene marinate, because his dialogue skills give him the power to have Leo keep talking about phrenology for 20 minutes. You know?
Yeah, but what is that specifically? I mean, is it long shots? Is it use of music?
Long takes are a big part of it. Music. I actually think his most suspenseful moments don't really lean on music at all. And even like if you look at the suspenseful moments in this movie, there isn't a lot of music throughout them. So yeah, his use of music, but in knowing that maybe music isn't the best choice, you know?
Right.
So yeah, and long takes are definitely a part of it too. Yeah. Like just the fact that he's able to keep your attention unbroken, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not even like, you know, the Samuel L. Jackson monologue is told in a one unbroken 3-minute take. It's that it's 3 minutes and there's editing throughout, but you know, it might be 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, but even the cumulative effect of a variety of, you know, shorter, but still longer takes, add something. Yeah.
Yep. Are we going to get more Channing Tatum in Quentin Tarantino movies?
I don't know. I think he fits.
How?
No, I just mean like as a performer, like I could see him doing a good job in another Quentin Tarantino movie.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I think everybody in this movie is great. Then I would not be surprised to see any of them again.
Yeah, any standouts or just all big, they all did their job?
Big Bob fan.
Yeah.
He is so good. And like, obviously, like really towing the line of caricature.
Yeah, he gets some bigger moments, so.
Yeah.
You get some standout moments, but.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the biggest laugh I got out of this movie is when he says, "But can you prove it, cabrón?" It's just so funny. And the fact that he's kind of like talking with his eyes closed, and I don't know. I thought he was really, really good. Everybody's good in this movie. Jennifer Jason Leigh, like in the moments where she's out of focus, she's unbelievable, you know, like, cause she's the one that really keeps moving throughout those things. But everybody's good. And Samuel L. Jackson was just born to read Quentin Tarantino dialogue. So, I would be fine if Samuel L. Jackson only acted in Tarantino movies for the rest of his life.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know, like everybody is a standout and everybody gets a moment to shine at some point, you know, like even OB, he has his moment when he comes back in from the cold.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah. Did that bit with the door have any importance, or just a good kind of well to go to for a laugh, to break up some of the tension every once in a while?
It's very funny. And especially the first time, like before we've even seen Michael Madsen's face, him yelling from off screen is so funny. I think it's just sort of like, you know, the sound of wind is just nonstop throughout this film, when they're in the haberdashery. And I think what the locking out or the boarding up of the door is meant to signify is that you can board up these natural things that are threatening you, but even if you're locked inside away from the natural world, you're not safe, you know. So I think that's about it, you know.
Okay.
That was my take on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else about Hateful Eight?
I just want to keep talking about it. I just loved it. I really love this movie, and I cannot believe that it felt for a movie of just people in a room talking for 3 hours and 7 minutes, I think it's the length of The Roadshow, and obviously that's including overture and intermission. It feels so fast, and I've seen it 3 times now, and it doesn't seem to slow down, even though I know where everything's going. And there's so many little things all throughout it where even, you know, Bruce Dern talking about the last time he saw his kid or something like that, where he's saying he came out to these parts to sort of find his fortune. And then we learn that Samuel L. Jackson is around. We learn who Samuel L. Jackson is. And it even, like, when Bruce Dern says he came out here to find his fortune, and then we cut to a close-up of him saying, and he never came back or something like that, as he sips his coffee that Walton Goggins handed him. That's even kind of like a nice pairing to the line where Samuel L. Jackson earlier says, you know, a lot of people came to kill me when I had that bounty on me. They came out here to find fame and fortune. Or sorry, they came out here to find me and get their fortune or whatever. He's like, they found me, you know? And and I think that there's a few really nice pairings of lines like that. And little things that you pick up on going through the movie again, where it really feels like every piece of information that is learned throughout this movie comes back later in the movie in some capacity. And I think, like, I cannot say enough good things about that sort of that structure. And I don't think anybody else could make that type of movie. And we are just so lucky to live in a world where people are as talented at making movies, you know. And Tarantino's not the only person, you know. I'm not holding up him up as the god of filmmaking. I'm holding him up as a god of filmmaking for sure. But I mean, the fact that there are probably 5 to 10 directors in the world that are this good at making movies will just warm my heart forever, you know.
Yeah, I think with the intermission, especially when you come back and, you know, it's such a hard reset, and we get Quentin Tarantino himself telling us, you know, in the last 15 minutes, this is what's been happening.
That's so good.
Yeah. I think I really like that, especially because, you know, you've kind of got this first half, and then it opens up with, okay, now let's look at this again. You know, like, there's something I appreciate about that intermission and about the director really coming in without being, you know, too on the nose about it, saying, not everything's what it seems. This is what this chapter is called because. Yeah. And even if you've been having fun, and, you know, that story that we leave on of Warren Samuel Jackson, it's, you know, it's obviously tense and ends with someone dying. But it's kind of goofy and silly the way that it's played off. And then, you know, we get this hard reset and we come back, and there was just something I really, really liked about the kind of the two act structure of, this is what happened, now let's re-examine that, see what really happened and what's going to happen next. And I do enjoy his narration there, and, you know, just kind of his input and just being the puppet master that, and kind of the craftsman that he is, I think really comes through in that, you know, just saying, okay, you've seen some of this, now reconsider it. I was the one who showed you all of this, so you definitely missed something. And, you know, now let's move on.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope he takes less than 3 years to make his next movie, for my own benefit. Yeah.
When when the script for this one leaked, he said he wasn't going to do this movie anymore, was going to release it as a novel and do a new one. And you never believed him for a second. Why were you so confident?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I like some properly placed confidence from time to time. And I was right. He's just such an impulsive guy that his movies are always going to be so well thought out and like the best version that they can possibly be, just because that's the thing he loves the most. But when he's talking into microphones in interviews and stuff like that, he talks so quickly. He's such an impulsive guy in general with his opinions and all that, and he's such an emotional person as far as movies and his movies are concerned, that you never should take the first thing he says about it at face value. You know, he is able to make these scenes where things are able to marinate because he has this patience in his filmmaking. He doesn't have this patience in his, like, regular life. Like, he's just moved so quickly. And we, in these things, we have to give him the time to marinate and be patient with his thoughts. And so that he can figure out that, hey, it leaked. I can still do better than people reading this PDF on their computer, you know, like,
yeah.
So
you get none of the visual style that he knows he's capable of achieving, right?
Exactly. Like, I'm sure if I read that novel, I would have been like, I really like this novel, but I wish he had made it into a movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And I also just don't think he'll ever write a novel. I think anything that he views as good enough to release to the public, he's gonna film it. Yeah, you know?
He's gonna want to make it better by the visual storytelling he's capable of.
Exactly, because he's one of the best writers in Hollywood for sure, and certainly one of the most unique writers. But the fact that he is both so good at writing and so good at directing really kind of gives him this sort of upper hand, you know, and yep. in such distinct ways. And I've mentioned a lot of filmmakers throughout this podcast that both write and direct their own movies. And I don't mean to talk down to them or anything, but there's just, like we said, there's something more distinct about his dialogue than there is in any other sort of director sort of movie. Like, the only screenwriter that is comparable is Aaron Sorkin for having movies that sound like Aaron Sorkin movies, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But Aaron Sorkin can't direct, you know, like, he can, but he directs like The Newsroom, where it's just a lot of Steadicam walk and talks, you know?
I can't think of another director where you could do, you know, even just a spoof in a TV show and say, this is Tarantino writing, this is Sorkin dialogue. Mm-hmm. I can't think of someone else who you could do that with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
How did you feel about them ending on the Lincoln letter? You know, the way that we go out of them reading that Lincoln letter, Warren, Samuel Jackson reading, kind of mouthing the words along with it, and the finish. Did you have any reading on that ending like that?
Well, I love that Samuel Jackson mouths the words. I really enjoyed that touch.
Yeah, that warmed my heart.
I think it's meant to tie into the Jesus shot from the beginning, or the crucifix shot from the beginning, in that Abraham Lincoln, like, the way that he is portrayed historically is that he's one of the best of us, you know, and he helped abolish slavery, and John Wilkes Booth still got him, you know. And I think it's just this bookend to this sort of nastiness that is inherent in the world, that it doesn't matter if you're good or bad, you're still gonna, like, it all ends horribly all the time, you know. And I think that's it. Of course, I know that the letter isn't actually written by Lincoln, and it ends up being sort of this false signifier of this person, but I think that falseness sort of adds something too, right? It's like,
yeah,
because it's the way that that people think of Lincoln, that letter fits in. Like, they see him as this sort of one of the best presidents ever, and such a strong figure in history for helping to abolish slavery and all that stuff, you know. And the falseness of it adds to that, and also that he got murdered, you know, or assassinated in his case. I think it's sort of, I don't know, it's a nice bookend for the movie, I think. And that we're craning up to another body that had its life end horribly while that letter's being read. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next time we put out an episode.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.